So we haven't done a predictions for 2016 show, Ethan.
I'm laughing because every article that had predictions for the new year in it, I reflexively and angrily deleted. It's like, you did a listicle with a buzzword that made me want to click. So are we going to do predictions now? Is that what you're telling me?
Well, you know, personally, I live in an environment of continuous delivery and continuous improvement. So the idea of coming up with like just one time a year where I actually do things better than last year, that doesn't seem like very DevOps to me.
because it's continuous. That's right. It's got to be constant. Right.
I'm better every single day. Damn it. But I tell you what, though, I've got one prediction. You want to hear my one prediction for 2016?
Tell me your one prediction. What is it?
You're going to spend more time than you can possibly imagine on the toilet looking at your smartphone.
I don't know. I can imagine kind of a lot of time.
I predict you spend more time in front of your smartphone and computer than you did in 2015. That's my prediction.
Okay, so I'm going to go off. I'm going to go orthogonal and riff right on that point. I love my iPhone 6S Plus and hate it at the same time. And I'm trying to take out the bits and pieces of it that make me hate it, because it's not it that I hate. It's the constant distraction that it's become. Okay, so there's a book I'm reading called Deep Work. And yes, Packet Pushers listeners, we're going to get to networking stuff in a bit here, but this will be interesting to anyone who is interested in their own personal productivity and how they learn and so on. So this book I'm reading, Deep Work by Cal Newport, it showed up pretty cheaply. I don't remember what I spent on it. It's an easy read and makes a lot of valid points. And one of the major points is we live in a world that's very distracted or constantly giving you distractions. Social media, it's intended, designed purposefully to keep you looking at it. Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all the other, whatever the kids are using these days that I've never heard of. And when you live in that world of distraction, your brain becomes addicted to the distraction, so that it's not merely an issue of my will is strong enough, I can quit Twitter anytime I want, stop looking at Facebook and so on. You can't actually, because you've addicted yourself to it. Your brain becomes normalized into this pattern of looking at information and very quickly getting a quick hit and then needing it again in a repeated way, which prevents you, getting to the deep work idea here, of being able to focus on one thing, a single thing, learning it deeply, being able to ponder it, think about it, problem solve with it, come up with big ideas that are in fact strong work, good, productive work that leads to breakthroughs in your job. And so on. So I'm guilty of this. I think most of us probably are. I really have been checking social media less and all that stuff, but my phone has been one of the things that's kept me prisoner. And so I've just started deleting apps. They're just gone. Twitter, gone. I won't be there unless I'm at a conference. I've shut down notifications so that things aren't bugging me. It's the notifications that get me more than the messaging app itself. Yeah. Like if Slack says, you have 15 new messages. Oh my gosh, I got to check them. No. Just turn all that stuff off and so on, which has helped enormously. And does the world miss me if I don't instantly react to every message that comes along? Nope. Am I missing valuable things going on in my life because I'm not looking at all the little things that my phone is vibing and notifying me about? Not at all. Am I getting to a point where I can start to do more deep work? It's going to be an uphill slog, I got to tell you, because of that addiction thing. I find I very impulsively want to open TweetDeck and look at Twitter and see what's going on in there, and it drives me bonkers. It's getting better, but it's been a struggle more than I thought to get to that mental point where you're in flow, you're pondering, you're understanding, you're able to read and research and build.
I think it's that flow. I remember when, like 15 years ago, and I could stick my head inside of a reader or a textbook or a RFC and just read it for hours and not be distracted. And these days I would find it incredibly difficult to focus on, you know, reading an OSPF white paper for 2 hours flat or even an hour.
I look back at my CCIE lab practice days. I used to be able to sit in my practice lab for 10 hours at a stretch. It took me several weeks and a few months to work up to that. But I was purposefully training myself so that when I went to take the actual lab, I knew I'd be able to sit for 8 hours. So I was overtraining by pushing myself to focus for 10. That's where I was at back in 2007, 2008. Could I do that today? Oh, gosh, no.
No. You wish.
And there was no Twitter back then. And, you know, Facebook might have been a thing. I guess I don't remember. But I was not on social media in the same way that I am now. I just had my blog. And that was my only my major distraction at that point.
I can't disagree. I mean, I've had very similar, you know, that staying focused and being able to focus in an environment where, but then again, I'm not just an engineer. 5 years ago, I was the senior architect and my job was to work with security, work with the server, work with virtualization, have vendors coming in, have executives coming in. You know, you were juggling inputs. Is that part of getting older and taking on a wider set of responsibilities, your ability to distribute your attention amongst multiple things?
You and I are guilty of not just having scattered attention and being, you know, involved in social media because that's part of what we do, but also taking on more things because we have busy minds and like to do new stuff all the time, which over time tends to break us down and break down our ability to focus, I think. As well. I don't know how much age has to do with it, because if you read Deep Work, the book, again, the book I'm reading, they would say, no, it has to do with your state of training as opposed to your age. And no matter what age you are, you can still be productive on a very deep level. And he cites a number of examples of folks that have done that. Well, anyway, we should probably quit staring at our navel. I mean, I found a lot of fuzz in there, but we should probably move on. Now, you had this idea. Yeah,
here's another tip for you, Ethan. No one cares about you.
That's exactly right. As we said on the show many times, no one cares about us. We're taking a quick break to tell you about a Packet Pushers public appearance. Ethan Banks, that's me, along with Greg Farrell, will be at the Aruba Atmosphere Conference at the Cosmopolitan of Las Vegas on Tuesday and Wednesday, March 8th and 9th, 2016. What's Aruba Atmosphere? Well, they say it is the largest mobility conference on Earth. We'll be there to record several podcasts with Aruba subject matter experts and chat with fellow conference attendees. And hey, maybe that's you. If you're going to be at Atmosphere, we'd like to meet you, shake your hand, and hear about the IT projects that you're working on. During the conference, keep your eye on the @PacketPushers Twitter account, and we will let you know exactly where we'll be at and when. And if you can't make it to the conference, check out the podcast from Aruba Atmosphere that we'll publish into the weekly show and priority queue feeds. So let's talk about some big ideas that you've had in your moments of focus, Greg. And one of these analogies we've been talking about in the back channel, I love it. It's this notion of data center as a factory and not a museum. Which is building on some ideas that we've had before about compostable infrastructure, as you've coined it. So what's your big idea
compostable.
Here?
Compostable infrastructure. I guess when I sit down and think, I've sort of been musing over why do so many of our data centers look like, you know, static, amorphous blobs of just this. And then I realized that you could walk through somebody's data center, and many times I have, and even today I do, and you walk through and they go, yeah, this is this, and there's a Solaris box over here, and here's a silly, you know, an SGI, and here's a mini computer from the 1970s. And I realized your data center is as much of a museum as it is a service production capability. Like
everybody's got some IBM AS400 running AIX sitting in the corner, still running some special app.
That's right. You know, and an awful lot of enterprise data centers are actually museums. They're full of outdated technology by most modern measures. And those things are really, they're not a feature. They're actually a bug in the sense that while they may be highly productive and profit generating service delivery items, they're not necessarily the most efficient machine that you could be using to achieve that task. And that, if you start looking at your servers, those heirlooms, as machines inside of a factory, right? Your data center is really a production factory for software services. So accounting, database analysis, customer relationship management software, sales management. If you're running a retail operation, it's going to be something that's monitoring the goods in and the goods out, the warehousing capabilities. All of those things are just services that your data center produces, and your data center is a factory. So if you think about it in that sense, right? You've got goods coming into the factory, compute, storage, network. They get chomped up by these software machines. Just like any factory, there's a machine that, you know, you feed in the raw material, iron or, you know, raw potatoes, and it goes down a production line and out the other end comes a finished good and then it gets shipped out. Make sense?
It does. And you're making a big point here. There's an emphasis not on the hardware, but on the end product.
Now, the other input to your data center is, of course, operations and maintenance. But what are the outputs from your data center? So I talked about services. What's the other one? Waste products.
Yeah, right.
Right? For every ton of steel you put into your factory that you're going to make a car, there's an awful lot of waste that goes out the other side.
Right? And in the context of a data center, what would you categorize as waste?
Servers that are 3 years old, switches that are more than 3 years old, racks.
And the really old ones that you dare not shut off for fear the fans will never spin back up again and yeah. It won't boot.
Or you keep them just in case.
Right.
You should really just say, look, that's a waste. That's an asset that's reached the end of its life. Just throw it straight in the bin. You don't sit there and hold bins full of if you're running a factory and you're a chip factory and you've got some leftover potato waste at the end, you don't keep it just in case you need to put it back in the front end of the machine again, do you?
This is a CapEx expenditure problem, though, I think. Let me explain what I mean by that. You know, some of those machines that you were talking about walking by, oh, I've got my SGI and I've got, you know, this, and I've got my HP Superdome and I've got my, you know, whatever it is. Those were, you know, six-figure, seven-figure acquisitions for some of these companies, and they've got to depreciate them over a very long period of time. As opposed to the more modern mindset, which is buy the cheapest crap you can, build out your infrastructure that you can swap those things out at will, and you don't need to be married to that, something that's going to be a museum piece before too awfully long. You get what I'm saying, right?
Well, it doesn't have to be a museum piece. It could be an heirloom piece.
Yeah.
The machine that's handed down for generation after generation of IT system administrator, you know, like, aka the IBM mainframe, you know. We are three life cycles into IBM mainframes.
I used to work for state government, and they found, after careful searching, a Unisys mini computer that they wanted to have as a backup to keep some Social Security Administration program running, you know, for example.
Yeah, whatever it is, right? It's like, and I guess the if you want to understand one big thing about the cloud, it's this idea that everything's disposable. That your hardware infrastructure should be regarded as consumable. They're not heirloom assets that you're going to buy and pass on to your children, right? It's much more like a printer cartridge. You buy it, you consume it, and then when it's finished with, you throw it straight in the bin or you recycle it, whatever it is that you're going to do. You know, I'll have a blog post on this in a few weeks, but I think the better way to think of your data center is not as a museum, and here's my, you know, and over here's the AS400. Look, it's in a specially sealed glass case with nitrogen in it to keep it ready for the next 50 years.
And there's velvet ropes that keep it walled yeah. off. And don't open the case, yeah.
And every now and then we have special educational tours for the young ones. But you know, those machines might, if you get stuck in that mindset, right, then you also get stuck in a mindset of, I can pay expensive amounts of money for that asset because it's going to last for years and years and years. And that creates a negative feedback loop where I'll pay more, and that's because it's going to last even longer, the more I pay for it. And then you start buying oversized units, and then you've got the spare capacity. So you keep using it because it's got plenty of spare capacity because you wasted too much money in the first place. And it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think you need to start thinking of your data center as a factory, servers, network switches, cables, SFPs, racks, whatever it is comes in. And as soon as it's finished, take the whole lot, throw it in the bin, and get it ready for the next goods in shipment.
So I agree with this in principle. This makes sense. You buy the cheapest stuff and you rotate through over time, adding capacity as you need it, retiring the old stuff, you know, no longer than 2 or 3 years in production, and off you go. Mm. However, the implication here is that you can take an application, whatever your application might be, and run it on that sort of infrastructure that is throwaway, that everything's able to be launched in a container, spread out over racks full of compute, you know, for example. But we know that that's not the case these days. There's very few shops that can actually do that. And so, in fact, you've got legacy apps that need to get stood up on something meaty or something specialized in whatever case it might be, which I think is part of the issue here. It's driven from the application down, in some cases, maybe what gets purchased.
Mm, you know, I don't want to take the metaphor too far, because I think, you know, I've got a nice little diagram here that you're looking at, and it sort of puts it all together and things. But I just think that, you know, the way we look at assets today is based on a 20-year-old business model of, we buy once and then never buy it again. And back in the 1970s and the 1980s, that was certainly true. You bought a machine, you put it on the factory floor, it was hard to buy, you used it until it basically wore out, and then you would look around and buy another one that would last you 10 to 20 years.
So, okay, but this is actually a good time to bring up Phil Gervasi's point on packetpushers.net, where he talks about being asked to review a proposal that had come in from Avar for, I forget the exact organization, where they were grossly overspecking, putting huge routers and switches, huge by the standards of what was actually required, because of this mindset. You know, I'm going to overbuy today. I've got budget, therefore I'm going to buy the biggest, baddest thing I can with 10 gig uplinks and blah, 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 things that were never, ever going to be needed, because it's like, how much growth are you planning for in an organization that was actually fairly static? You know, and Phil makes a great point there. If you go up to Packet Pushers Net and search for saving millions, I think you'll find that article pretty quickly. Yep. It's a bogus mindset, you know, buying what you think you might someday need versus what you actually are going to need.
Yeah. That's like being 18 years of age and buying a family sedan, because one day you'll have a family and four kids and a wife.
Exactly.
And you'll be, you know, do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
You just don't do that. Right. So why are you doing it in your, anyway, that's enough.
And I want to go back to my point about applications, which is this. I think someday we are going to get to the point where the average application is quote unquote cloud native. We're going to go through that transition. It's going to take a while, but that's going to become a thing that lends itself to this sort of an architecture. And then IT is going to be able to adapt to that. It's just not going to happen tomorrow or next year, or probably the year after that either. I think it's going to be a 5 to 10 year shift, at least, to get us to that sort of a point where you could expect, yes, you can buy our application in container form, and we'll run with your container orchestration platform to distribute the load around. Yeah, everybody does that. That's obvious. That's the standard way to do IT. I suspect we'll get there eventually, maybe.
Here's some advice. You know all of that stuff that you've got sitting in the corner of your data center that you're keeping just in case you need it one day? Throw it away. Because that stuff is holding you back.
Yep.
That stuff isn't letting you move on. If you've got a bunch of, you know, Dell 380s from a decade ago because you might use them for something, you're holding yourself back. Just
but the bezel's still shiny.
They're always going to be shiny, you know, but they're just, you're never going to use them. And if you are, you're better off buying one new server that can run 250 VMs than you are even bothering to take that thing and power it up and put an operating system on it, because it's not going to run anything that runs modern.
You put it in the rack, and any engineer that knows what the machine actually is compared to what has come as new and standard is going to look at that old machine and go, oh, it's cute. I wonder what I can still do with it.
Got better things to do than apply BIOS updates to eight-year-old servers. So private clouds. You don't hear a lot about people talking about private clouds, do you? Really?
Well, in a sense, it's like teenage sex. In theory, everybody's doing it, but no one's talking about it.
I'm with you there, right? But you hear a lot about public clouds. It's like there's trumpets, there's angels coming down from heaven, there's, you know, Moses is down with his tablets with the commandments of how thou shalt get to the cloud. Every time AWS, you know, seems to drop the smallest piece of information about a micro advance in its products, the analysts all come out and clap and cheer and you know, and then conferences are held to celebrate the latest instantiation of platform as a service, even though we've been talking about it for 5 years, as if it's like the greatest coming forever. Have you ever wondered why we don't hear about the private clouds?
In what you mean, I mean, I do hear about private cloud, but you're talking about actual production implementations, companies that are doing it?
Yeah, you don't see people standing up on stage at conferences and saying, we built a private cloud and it does this.
So what is your reasoning that we don't hear that very often?
Okay, well, let me tell you about why you do hear about a public cloud first. Why is it that people who make public clouds are out there talking about them, right? First of all, I'm standing up in front of a crowd talking about my public cloud because I need to recruit staff. Recruiting staff is expensive. Recruiting staff who know cloud technologies, because there are no cloud technologies, they're all new. So you've got to go and find people who've got that. So if you stand up at a conference and say, I'm building cloud, you're probably going to be able to have a beer with those people afterwards, and then you're going to recruit them for your company. And that's a hell of a lot cheaper than $20,000 to $40,000 worth of recruiter fees. Fair?
Fair.
So send your people along to conferences and talk, especially their executives, and then they can go looking for people to recruit. Two, it's free marketing. If you can put your Netflix people on stage at a conference, guess what they're doing? Promoting Netflix to the audience. Free marketing, especially for companies in the public cloud who are often poor and not very good at you know, not very good at marketing or not very good at, don't have enough money to do proper marketing, free marketing is good marketing. Fair?
Keep going.
Why do so many public clouds get participation in open source? Why do they make open source software and sell it and put it out there for everybody? Why do they do that, do you think?
And why are there so many competing open source projects, I suppose, is part of the answer to this question.
Yeah. So 20 years ago, companies used to develop their own software and then use them. Okay. But then they'd be on the hook for maintaining the thing themselves. Well, if you can open source it and find 20 other companies to come and use your product, you've just split the workload amongst 20 other people. Win. Total win, right? The software that you've got is now being developed by other people. So now you're not having to pay for all the developers that are going to, and your testing exposure is increased. And hopefully those people are going to develop features that increase your business opportunity. That's free money. So that's why they do a lot of this open source. And that's why you hear about public clouds, because they're out there talking about their open source.
It's a shared risk and it's shared labor. And you know, everybody is paying their money to be a part of these projects, depending on the project. I'm still with you. Keep going.
Still with me, Ricky. The second thing about open sourcing a project is you can get other people trained on your product. So if you've custom developed this app, and then you push it out there for other people to use, you've just reduced your recruiting pool to a very easy to use. Your internal training cost just dropped because you can just go and get people from other companies and hire them. So again, recruiting. Third one, fourth, fifth one, ego. There's nothing like a little bit of human ego to go and stand up at conferences and believe that you're actually important, because speaking at a conference can make you feel important if you're in that sort of mind. Number six, competitive advantage. A lot of public cloud people see that if you're going to the public cloud early enough, you can psych out your competitors by saying, we're faster, you know, we're in the public cloud, we're doing something you're not. And then all of a sudden you force your competitor to make a move to counter a perceived advantage you might have. Now, that's actually a very thin one, because arguing about strategic advantages or competitive advantages in the public cloud, like, that's pretty thin. But I think my final argument as to why you hear about the public clouds, especially for small startups, if you're out there talking about your public cloud experience, remember that 90% of all startups are going to crash. They're going to fail and you're going to walk away with nothing. And so this is a way of making sure that you're going to get onto your next job. So if you get out there and well-known, so that's why people get out there. Those seven reasons.
Just on that last point, I mean, what you're really getting at there is startups that stand up their own infrastructure on public cloud, and now it's a portable skill. Oh, yeah, we built our company on public cloud. Well, it was less risk for the investor who didn't have to buy a bunch of crap that now they've got to liquidate since the startup blew up. And the startup people are happy because they can go to wherever the next startup is they're going to go and say, I know how to do public cloud. Woohoo, look at me.
Woo-hoo. And look, here's my resume. I was standing at conferences telling everybody how awesome I was and writing blog posts and Twittering about my latest, you know, Docker on a switch type stuff. So, you know, follow the money. The reason people in public clouds are talking about their public clouds is because it's money. It makes money. It saves money. It helps you keep the money going into the future. It's always about the money, right? So private clouds.
Public cloud is bloody expensive if you do it, depending on how you do it, I think. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead. Go ahead. Keep going.
All right. So the point is, why do you not hear about private cloud? Now, to understand that, you've got to understand why people talk about public cloud, because that's where the money is, right? But being private is, it's not about the money. And that's the weird thing, because the funding for enterprise IT isn't about saving money or spending more money or whatever. It's about, number one, competitive advantage. If you're implementing IT in enterprise, you're trying to change faster than your competitor. You're trying to be more efficient, to handle a larger capacity, to compute data in a smaller period of time. So you don't want to tell your competitor what you're doing, so you don't talk about it, right?
I'm not sure I buy that entirely. Let's think about this competitive advantage, because you know the argument you made previously about public was, I'm going to talk about public because it's going to drive people to do the same thing, because they'll think, oh my gosh, they've got an advantage. You know, and in private, you're just saying, oh, they're keeping it secret because they don't want anybody to know.
There's a difference between a strategic advantage and a competitive advantage.
Mm.
If you're in a market and you're a new entrant, and you suddenly rock up and say, I'm going to be doing this new business model totally better than anybody else who's in the market, that's a strategic advantage, if you will, or strategy advantage. A competitive advantage is, I've just implemented a new IT system that makes me 40% more efficient. I'm now able to produce the same good at a 40% cheaper price because I've got a technology advantage.
Fair enough. Okay.
That's very real. Like, it's a subtle difference, right? But in enterprise IT, that's the reality, is it's mostly about making something more efficient, faster, better. You know, making your factory more efficient gives you a profit advantage. But that's not very interesting to talk about at a conference, though.
No.
Okay. Number two, you don't hear about private clouds because it costs a lot of money in time travel and supervision to send your best engineers away to travel. And if you're a traditional business that's actually making real money, unlike most of the people in the public cloud who aren't actually making all that much money, letting your staff go, who are often very highly paid, is a serious cost.
Because you need them around doing some deep work, if you will, to improve the infrastructure, make it more consumable, keeping up with upgrades, testing what your next iteration of private cloud is going to look like, because that's very much something that's going to be going on more or less constantly, the next pod to move to. As soon as you turn them loose for a week, you're giving up a week. Even if it's a one-day or two-day conference, you're losing them for a week. They got to travel, hotel, overnight, preparation, et cetera. They're gone. That's a lot of lost productivity. I'll completely buy that, yeah.
How do I measure the gain of getting my people to spend to a conference? So remember, in enterprise IT, everything has to have a measurable gain. Or in a traditional company, they don't send you the conference just for the funds, or to give you a break, or to give you a pat on the back and say, that's awesome, generally. There has to be some measurable value that accretes to the company. And yet all the things we talked about in the public cloud aren't actually measurable. Better recruiting, give myself some free advertising, get some software. If I share it with other people, I might get a return, right? So you can't actually measure the advantage of going to, so it's very difficult for people to let you go and speak at conferences and make things. Number four, legal. There are, in certain industries, it's a massive legal risk if you get up and talk about your IT infrastructure in public.
Financial particularly, I've worked for at least one company that was draconian about it. You were not allowed to speak in public under any circumstances. And of course, we've seen this at the ONUG conference too, Greg, where certain sessions are closed door because it needs to be not exposed to anyone who would be considered media or speaking with the public. Had to be closed door sessions for this reason. So yeah, valid point. Yeah.
Number five, IT security. Remember that by telling people outsourcing your project, you're open sourcing your project, you're actually telling people what your internal infrastructure is like. And if I decide to be malicious, if I'm somebody who wants to attack you, now I've got your source code and I can start looking for vulnerabilities. Expand that to, if you stand up on stage and say, hey, I bought product X, you've just told me what's in your data center, and I've now just achieved a major piece of reconnaissance on how to attack your company. That's a genuine...
If you're building private cloud, if all that's known is that you're building private cloud, there's not that many options as far as what that's going to look like. So if you're a hacker, you can make a few assumptions, and as long as you can get a foothold, you can probably figure that out. But yeah, it's a valid point. You don't expose worse.
I can go and watch your conference talk and get some sense, get some valuable reconnaissance and some social engineering data about your organization.
Sure.
Right? And then finally, brand security is the last one. This is a bit thin. Often there's always a chance that they'll stand up, especially if you're a long-term enterprise company, you've been around for 100 years, and you speak and say something, there's actually possible brand security issues where you might actually damage the brand. So I think those issues sort of summarize. There's more, right? I'm sure there's lots more. I stopped here because I think I made my point. Sit down, drop the mic, clear the floor. But you get the idea. The reason that you don't hear about the private cloud is because there are genuine reasons not to go out there and say, I built a private cloud. People are out there just getting on with it.
So I'll put it this way, what we know of private cloud and all the different people that we've talked to that are building them, there's a couple of different camps here. So I'm just going to give a little bit of a different slant on why people aren't talking about it as much. One, it's VMware and it's really expensive and there's not that many people that are doing it. There's some, they are, but not that many. That is one reason. It's an expense problem for them. Another is, they're using OpenStack. OpenStack is still the one that gets all the media attention. It may not be the most wonderful product to work with in the world, certainly. And so therefore, there's a lot of folks who are maybe looking at it but struggling to know how to get it into production. So it's all in trial right now. Not that many people are running production OpenStack. Another would be containers, and this actually comes from a article I read in the Container Journal just this week. Why aren't containers taking off was the premise of it. And the point was made because it's overkill. Who needs a container infrastructure? You know, if, assuming containers are part of your private cloud strategy, and they may not be, but that's certainly the sexy thing. You know, oh, we're going to Docker everything and that's going to be great. But do you really need Docker or containers in general for your infrastructure? And the answer is the vast majority of IT operations don't. Containers are designed for applications that work at massive scale, and they are designed to be automated in such a way that you can operate at massive scale without human beings standing up a bunch of pets. They're meant to be cattle that you stand up a process, off you go, run it and kill it, and it was all done automatically for you. You know, how many of you, if you're thinking about your data center and your IT shop, actually need that sort of on-demand infrastructure where you're standing up and shutting down thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of containers to handle your workloads? Not most of you. And so therefore, people aren't as much talking about private cloud, I think. It's not designed for everybody.
I agree with you, right? But my question is, why the hell would you expect it to actually be something? Like, why would it replace everything? It's not a question of why it hasn't replaced every technology. The question is, why would it? It's only just arrived. It's unproven. None of the companies who actually support it have even taken it out of beta yet. The whole ecosystem still developed. We're still having an argument around whether it's going to be Mesosphere or Kubernetes or some other orchestration platform. Why would you go and start investing your bucks in this stuff?
And therefore, especially for the, you know, the mid-market, all of this stuff is something other people are doing, and it's going to be that way for a while. And there's vendors that are going, no one's asking me for any of this stuff. Why would I give it to them? Because yes, everyone's still buying the same thing that they've been buying, just bigger. And no, it isn't advancing the art of IT necessarily, but Greg, as you were just saying a moment ago, maybe we don't need all this fancy stuff just yet, at least not until, as an industry, we figure out what the new brave new world is going to look like and kind of rally around it, and then can start banking on some reference architectures that we know are going to be around 5 years from now.
Yeah, it's going to take years and years and years. And sure, lots of people are going to be able to have a play. And, you know, I remember back when fourth generation databases came on the scene in 2000, 2001. You know, everybody raced off to get into these fourth generation database languages and hoo-ha, hoo-ha, blah, 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 whatever. And it just didn't work out the way, you know, and they're dead now. So if you're going to want me to invest, you know, multiple millions and decades of investment cycle time, just give it a chance to hook in. I mean, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. Don't believe your own hype, you know.
As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. It's kind of hard to see what you don't own, and that becomes a big problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services on outsourced infrastructure. Figuring out what's gone wrong and who's responsible can take hours, and in some cases, weeks. And what about planning ahead to avoid those issues in the first place? So that brings us to our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. Your corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider network, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. Together, these vantage points provide the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. Again, the networks you own and the networks that you don't. So let's consider this. How does all of this data from ThousandEyes help you out? And there's really three things you should consider. One, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. In other words, you can tell what's going on in the internet BGP routing tables and how DNS is resolving, etc., and pull all that information together. Two, you can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems, device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, hijacks, route leaks, DNS failures, service provider outages. In other words, whatever's really going on, you can get right to the source of the problem with ThousandEyes. Three, you can take that data that you've found, those insights that you've gathered from the ThousandEyes interface, and then you can share it with vendors, with your customers. The big idea here is you can resolve your problems faster because you can say, hey, look what I found. So do you like what you hear? Good. Even better, there is a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at www.thousandeyes.com/packetpushers, and you can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see.
So, Greg, you and I run a business, and we've noticed the economic downturn a bit as some of the folks that would sponsor packet pushers to talk about their amazing products to our engineering audience have maybe backed off a bit. And it seems that that's kind of endemic across the board. China's down, a lot of other fears, people starting to conserve cash and so on. And I guess you found a piece here that suggests the enterprise has stopped buying stuff.
Yeah, it's sort of a general thing. If you look at the financial analysis, so over on the Network Break podcast, which I do every week, I do a bit of a section. When the companies announce their results, I very quickly try to summarize it in about 90 seconds or less because it's boring. But what we've seen is that most of the enterprise IT companies, especially firewall and security companies around, and a lot of the infrastructure companies, have announced that the next quarter or two will be soft. That is, sales will be down by 5 to 10%. Against previous predictions around where they're going to go.
Yeah, and everybody's soft in a variety of ways. Maybe not a decline, but maybe just softer year over year.
Yeah.
Not as much growth. I mean, Cisco was soft. Juniper was soft.
Microsoft is down.
Yeah.
Especially in the enterprise, like the sales of Office and Windows Server licenses and that sort of thing. Azure's doing great. You
know. Arista surprisingly strong, considering the lawsuit and all the rest there. They seem to be doing fantastic.
That's right, but you look at, say, A10 Networks, F5 got hammered because of its, its predictions in sales were down.
F5 partly down because they're saying, well, our customers are trying to figure out public cloud, so, yeah, anyway.
Lots and lots of different things happening in that space. It's sort of symptomatic that generally across the board, and then I've read some different analyst reports sort of saying the enterprise is going to slow down its buying in 2016. It's only going to grow. The total enterprise IT market might grow by 3.5%. So there's a line here from the IDC. They posted a report like the networking market's going to grow 3.5% to reach $41.1 billion in 2016. But the enterprise IT market overall, in terms of traditional, you know, servers, compute, storage, IT infrastructure, data center spending, that sort of stuff, that will shrink by 5 to 10% in 2016, while enterprise IT takes a pause, is what they're saying. Does that make sense to you? Are we stopping buying enterprise IT?
Everybody still needs compute of some sort. Now, if you go back to the argument of we buy and over-engineer when we buy because we don't know when the next time is we're going to get money because of the standard IT mindset, then this makes sense. If there's a reason to conserve cash, typically you can conserve in IT in certain regards. Now, there's engineers out there cringing right now because they're running a six-year-old ASA firewall that they desperately need to upgrade, and they've gotten told that that line item got canceled from the budget, and they're like, oh my gosh, I got to get that thing out of the rack. I feel your pain, but generally speaking, from a business perspective, they look at their IT and go, it's still producing and doing what I need. There is nothing my CIO or my IT managers are telling me is holding me back in this infrastructure, and we can coax it along for another year. So that's one of the places I'm going to conserve cash, and I think it's one of the first places they go to because it can be, from a CapEx perspective, certainly a big cost center. So yeah, if we're assuming global economic slowdown, I'm not surprised to see that prediction.
It's all those things. I think what we're seeing is, you know how we talked about those heirloom assets? You know, storage array for $1 million. X86 servers that you could buy from Supermicro for a couple of $1,000s, but you buy blade servers that cost $40,000 and you need to buy a new chassis to get one more server. Well, you delay that. You put a few more VMs or something. You know, you do something to get by, right? And I think right now it makes much more sense for everybody to say, instead of just continuing, give it a sec. I'll push my purchases back for 6 months and see what it looks like. Or maybe I'll buy the cheaper thing in case the economic, or maybe the budget's been cut by 20% because the economic slowdown means it makes good sense to start building a cash buffer inside your company to get over the bad times that look like they're coming. So if you're seeing that in your workplace, you're not the only people, is what I wanted to say. I wanted to sort of, ultimately, IT is made of people. The point is that the slowdown in the economic situation will be fairly widespread across enterprise IT. That also means that your jobs are at risk, right? And you should start seriously thinking about saving a little bit extra money just in case you do go through a nasty little downsizing routine.
So moving the topic ahead, Mr. Farrell, one of the things we've noticed here in the last, couple of years particularly, is the increasing might and influence of the Linux Foundation. So you know, for me, Linux Foundation first popped up on my radar as a significant thing in the networking world because of the Open Daylight Project. ODL was and is a consortium of vendors that pay money to participate in the project, contribute code, and are actively and continuing to make this Java-based software-defined networking controller with a bunch of northbound and southbound protocols and a whole lot of different projects that are tied up in ODL. They continue to do new releases. Drew and I were just briefed on the latest release, and the project continues apace. You know, okay, ODL and Linux Foundation, and that's a thing, and there was the ODL Summit. I went to the first one they had a couple of years ago and attended that. And the Linux Foundation was the umbrella organization that incubates the project and gives it infrastructure and gives it administration and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Well, now there's a lot of things that are tied up in the Linux Foundation. It's not just ODL. I mean, there's another big controller project called Onos, for example, that was recently absorbed by the Linux Foundation. And
it was previously standalone and now is absorbed by the foundation.
Yeah, well, right. It had a lot of love from the Open Networking Foundation, Onos did, and I think that connection is still there with OnLabs, and now but now Linux Foundation runs it. And OPNFV, the Open Framework for Network Functions Virtualization, a really telco and service provider driven project, is under the Linux Foundation. And I'm on the DPDK mailing list. I was going to say Intel DPDK, but that's actually a misnomer now. Intel was the start of DPDK, but they've since, you know, it's its own thing now, released to the world. DPDK, according to their announcement list, is very likely coming into the Linux Foundation fold soon. The Open Networking Summit operates under the Linux Foundation. We've seen the Linux Foundation governance change a bit, where it's harder as an individual to have your say, and it's much more organization-oriented to influence what's going on within the Linux Foundation and the various projects.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of, it's a powerful thing, isn't it?
So over on the network break again, we have a joke about the Network Foundation of the Week.
Oh, no. Did you find another one?
Yeah. So the one I found today was there's a new one called the Open Connectivity Foundation, which is to do with the Internet of Things. Oh, isn't that great?
It's exciting. Great? It is exciting.
Last week it was Nokia. They were doing one around something to do with 5G, I think. Anyway, so we actually have a little segment where every week I talk about a new foundation that the Linux Foundation has brought online. Oh, in networking, boy. It's kind of like a running joke. It really is.
I think the larger point of all of this stuff is we're seeing the Linux Foundation, from a certain point of view, become an organization that is really replacing standards bodies. Or you could argue that. I mean, the people that are involved in standards bodies, many of whom listen to this show, would argue against that, I think, and fairly. But still, you got to look at what's happening in networking and in the compute world and go, what is happening? Where is all the action? Where is all of the influence and most of the attention being focused? And go, it is tied up in these projects. Yes. I mean, who knows what the IETF is doing? Well, no one, unless you're in the IETF or you're paying attention to it.
Would never be.
The noise isn't there. The buzz isn't there. The activity and action doesn't seem to be there in the same way. I mean, there is some, right? We know this.
Yeah.
But
well, I think there's a couple of things going on here. So first of all, the Linux Foundation is very corporate friendly, shall we say, in the sense that corporates can afford to flood a foundation with people. And the Linux Foundation is a very good organization for setting up rules so that collaboration can occur, but letting it happen naturally. So the thing that we saw with the Open Daylight Project, for example, is that code is the coin of the realm. So he who contributes the code gets to define the future of the project. Remember that?
Absolutely. And it's still a guiding principle that they have.
That they have, and that's very much a Linux Foundation thing. He who contributes the code gets to take the project in the direction that they want to go. Therefore, that's very attractive to corporates who want to be able to do what I – remember I said about the private cloud thing? If I take a project, open source it, other people come along and contribute to it, now I've got a pool of people. Now, for corporate companies or corporate vendors who want to sell services, that also means customers come along and participate and help with the product development. So vendors don't have to gamble on product development decisions, and they also have a constant feedback loop, and then they also get to just spread the costs of project development around a bit as well. So the Linux Foundation is very corporate friendly. Now, you're going to get into a situation soon where people are going to start pointing their finger at the Linux Foundation and saying, is it too corporate friendly? Is it too focused on making its customers happy? Because its customers are the big vendors who are forking over hundreds and thousands and millions of dollars to be platinum members or gold members or silver members of these foundations, right?
Which is a very different ethos from Linux and the kernel and screw you guys, this is what we're going to do because we're going to change the world. We're Linux. Oh, it's,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's peace, a different man. Vibe. Peace, man. It's all about freedom for the peoples.
Yeah.
Right. If you know what I'm saying. Yes. So the flip side of this is look at the other bodies which have been sort of driving the future of networking for the last 30 years. And I'm talking here about the IEEE, the IETF, the ITU, right? And just how much value are they generating now in 2016? Are they worth, I mean, I've been fairly open about my frustration with those organizations. Maybe the Linux Foundation is a better answer than the IETF, or the certainly better than the IEEE.
Well, there's a distinction here in that the Linux Foundation is not producing actual standards. They're producing what I will categorize as de facto standards in the form of actual functional working software, which Russ White, friend of ours, friend of the show, has been a big IETF advocate. He's been involved for many years, and he's pointed out that's what the IETF at one time did. It was code plus standard, and we end up with a rough consensus, and off we go. It's just a different animal now, you know, mired down in politics and a lot of cat herding from everything that we understand and hear. I'll be real interested to get your report, Greg, if you are still planning to go to the next IETF in Germany.
Yeah, I am. I promised him I would, and I'm planning to go to Berlin for IETF 96. So if you're going to be there, I'd love to see you. I'll be stalking the halls. I won't be speaking or anything. Or at least I don't have any plans to at this point in time.
So long story short, what is the point of all this? And the point is, you know, the times they are a change, and the Linux Foundation, if you haven't been paying attention, has become enormously powerful and influential because of the number of significant projects important to networking that have come under its umbrella and under its care and feeding. Again, recently, governance changes, shifting away from individuals to some degree and more towards corporations, mean what is this foundation and what's it doing that it has such a huge influence? It's something strongly to keep an eye on, especially if you haven't noticed this transition happening and you're still looking for the latest RFCs and so on. It's a different world that's quite beyond that now.
Yeah, I guess it just comes down to this care and attention to, you know, Linux foundations are being set up and their purposes are often commercially driven. They're not necessarily, these foundations don't necessarily operate in your best interests. They are easily able to be swayed by a company who wants to drive an open source project in a certain direction that may be to their competitive advantage. So they will throw money at the problem, buy their way to the top of the foundation project, put resources in to contribute code, and then maybe cut off what is a very promising avenue of research or the right way to go about something and say, actually, that's a competitive disadvantage to us, so we're going to drive it to the right. I don't know that you know, necessarily what's happening, but I'm saying that's certainly a risk.
Mm.
If I was to be cynical, which I am.
Fair enough.
You know, whereas the IETF is open, its processes are all done in public. Some of the Linux foundations don't necessarily open up all their things. You have to be a member to see secret meeting minutes and agendas and, you know, that sort of stuff. They're not necessarily open to everybody because platinum members have access to information that, you know, non-foundation members can't get to.
However, if we're going to talk about the IETF, yes, they operate in the open and all of that. But, I mean, who are the people that are putting the efforts into the IETF and writing the RFCs? They all work for vendors, too. It's not as clean of a cut as all that. I mean, individuals are still going to have a big struggle to have an impact on the IETF and the proceedings. I think I'm making a pragmatic observation there about how the IETF really works. Still, your point does stand. Well, one closing topic here before we close this off, Greg, which is SD-WAN and where are we now? So in 2015, Packet Pushers talked about software-defined WAN a lot. Why? Because it was a truly software-defined application that is immediately applicable to almost every network. And therefore, it's kind of an easy thing to sell as opposed to software-defined networking generally that's kind of this
thing and what am I going to do with it? And I got a software to find my network because that's all what it says in the media and that's cool. It's not that. It's actually a bundled product that's got a specific application. It fits into the world. It's got an ROI that is calculable. You can put a number to it and make that purchase make sense or not. Okay. Well, the first generation of SDN was about what? And I would categorize it as path management being the big one. I'm yep. going to use the internet, and I'm going to determine which path across these multiple internet links is the best one for a given application, and then making it easy to deal with rather than carefully and lovingly turning up a new WAN circuit with bated breath. Is the link going to come up? It's up! And assign IP addresses and configure a routing protocol and whatever else you got to do. It's jam the circuit in there, get your DHCP address, it gets absorbed into the system, and now you're pushing traffic across it. Just things going more easily, and then able to manage that WAN as a whole, really looking at it holistically. And with many of the vendors that came on to Packetbush to talk about their products, that's the way they operated. They don't all, just because it says SD-WAN, they don't always do all of those things, but that was a big value prop. So where does SD-WAN go next, I think? And Greg, I know you had some thoughts here and some observations to make.
Mm. So we've had a couple of briefings. We're very lucky that the SD-WAN vendors continue to talk to us and advise us about what's happening. And I think There's two things happening here with SD-WAN. One is a technology trend, and the other one is a business trend, right? So we know that we've got this ability now to stop building our own MPLS networks or to consume MPLS networks. That is, when I say consume, what's the purpose of MPLS for our carriers? And it's that they've got this big pool of bandwidth on their backbones, and what they do is they slice and dice it into pieces, and they use MPLS to do the slicing and dicing. It's a network virtualization technology. Not a very good one, right? Because the point of MPLS is that there's an A end and a B end. It's not broadcast to broadcast. It's not any to any. It's actually point A to point B was the original intention behind MPLS. And we've sort of put some nasty hacks into it over time to make it a bit more useful.
Okay, you're on your MPLS unicorn right now. I mean, back in the day, it was all about tag switching and conserving hardware resources. But anyway, the point stands that, yeah, what it's used for today is largely network virtualization in various forms, but I think Layer 3 VPN probably being the most common service mm-hmm. provider app. That means you can use Verizon Business and I can use Verizon Business, and never should our traffic bleed over into one another's virtual networks. Anyway, so
fantastic. MPLS, you know, allowed us to have private WANs mm-hmm. that didn't have to have encryption on them because we couldn't do encryption at high speed. So SD-WAN allows you to do high encryption at high speed for a start. So now you don't need
public transport viable.
And so you can now start to use the internet. So that means you can now just use commodity bandwidth, and you can cut 40 to 50% off your WAN bandwidth almost overnight, right? Even if you're replacing your routers, you can still get a one-year ROI. And that's the sort of stories that we've talked about in the year gone by. Now that we've got that down on the ground, what does that mean? A lot of big enterprises find it very difficult to be in 500 places at once, so they outsource that part of it to companies who have 500 places. So if they do business in 500 places, why not get them to go and do it? So in the UK, it's very common for normal companies to outsource their WANs to people like BT or, you know, companies who do that WAN operations, and they have staff all over the country who get in cars and go and replace routers and things. If you're doing that, why aren't you just using SD-WAN boxes? And we've started to see the sign of that this week, for example, where Viptela signed an exclusive deal with Verizon in their managed service provider division, not in Verizon's backbone or whatever. Verizon has a division which runs WANs for corporate companies, and Viptela has signed a deal to sell exclusively to Verizon. Verizon can choose to do business with whoever they like. They can still go and buy Cisco iWAN or, you know, any one of the other SD-WAN, Telari, VeloCloud, whatever. But Viptela has signed a deal to actually work with Verizon Managed Services to start replacing routers with their SD-WAN capability. So think about that. If you're a managed services provider, instead of waiting 3 months for the backbone division to pull in a private MPLS circuit, they can start to just put bandwidth in there. And their managed service contracts, they start to win more of them.
Which, by the way, you know, that deal that Viptela signed with Verizon is not a unique thing in the SD-WAN world. Oh my gosh, an SD-WAN provider signed on to, you know, as an MSP function within a carrier. Well, there's other SD-WAN platforms that can do that function and have those deals in place. This is just the latest one to hit the news. I mean, VeloCloud comes to mind immediately as having a very strong MSP play.
That's right. So that's the second phase. They go out, they hit the enterprise. The enterprise can buy small amounts of this product. It's a fast sales cycle compared to these managed service providers. So we're seeing the second generation of sales into these managed service providers coming through. I think that's a trend about SD-WAN that you're going to see many, many more of these MSPs turning up on your site saying, we're just going to use an SD-WAN. No, we don't need private MPLS. We're just going to use bandwidth, right? And that's going to attack the MPLS backbone. But that's a different problem. That's not something I want to talk about today. Now, I think the second thing that you're going to see is this SD-WAN providers themselves are going to start to talk about the SD-WAN boxes being firewalls, load balancers, proxies, IDSs, scanning, traffic logging, analytics. So they're going to say, what we want that SD-WAN box to be is a network functions virtualization platform. And we're going to start putting all this. So just the same as VMware NSX did in the data center, they started off just being a virtual switch that was programmable, and then they turned into, oh, we do firewalling, oh, we do load balancing, oh, we do traffic monitoring, oh, we've got analytics, oh, we've got... They're just loading all this functionality into the virtual switch in the VMware NSX, and same thing's happening with Cisco ACI and all of those data center providers. That's the next generation of SD-WAN that you're going to start to see, is these SD-WAN providers start saying, oh, yes, no, every one of our boxes has a stateful firewall built in. Every one of our boxes has an Active Directory instance built in.
Yeah, but that's interesting to enterprises. I don't think that's interesting to service providers. So I want to understand where you're making – I mean, does that play? I don't think a service provider like Verizon is going to ask their Viptela box to do that. I think they look at a Viptela box
absolutely,
and say –
Oh, absolutely, they will. Absolutely, because they want to sell more stuff to the enterprise. So if I can sell you a firewall at the branch and then charge you an extra dollars per month, or replace the firewall that you've got at the branch, or do
I don't think that's right. I think here's what I think is going to happen from a Verizon perspective. Viptela is a service that they can sell. They're going to run it as NFV on top of their much larger NFV architecture that includes a whole bunch of other things like firewalling and whatever else that you're describing that may be there. They're not going to look to a Viptela to provide that. They are going to provide that way, and the Viptela is going to be just one more service alongside of those other sorts of NFV functions.
I think that there are other parts of the big carriers who believe they can do firewall and malware scanning in the POP, but managed service providers need something that's going to work today. And you're not going to wait 5 years or 10 years for Verizon to deploy massive scale projects that, you know, deploy millions of firewalls. They've got a need for hundreds of firewalls for a single customer. I think there's a scale difference there. So again, the managed service provider trend is
and I don't disagree with that. I'm just saying I don't see it in the SD-WAN platform itself having that functionality, I guess, unless you're defining a very specific market of service provider that would use it in that way.
I think the managed service providers will. What the carriers do as network functions virtualization in their, you know, 5G towers or in their MPLS backbones in the POPs is going to be that's many, many, many years away, because they're going to work at such scale. They'll need millions of firewall instances or a way to provide firewalls for millions of customers. And it's going to take years to build systems, like simple operational systems around that functionality.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. And the reason I say that is there are some serious projects underway right now to make this happen. One that we've been briefed on, although not recently, was the under the Onos controller project, Cord, re-architecting that POP and the data center in that to become, instead of a bunch of precious bits of hardware that do very specialized things and are hard to orchestrate, NFV those functions onto an x86 platform driven by an Onos controller, bringing up and turning down those services on demand as customer needs them. I didn't get the vibe that that was super far away. You know, maybe I'm kidding myself. I'm not sure that an SD-WAN box is the right place to make those sorts of higher functions anyway. Could be for certain players, but I see that more as a service chaining play maybe. Hand the traffic off to the SD-WAN box. It comes out, chain it over to, you know, somewhere else, and then and then off it goes.
So I would think that's the way Cisco would like to see it. For example, they have their UCS E-Series blade, which goes inside of a 3900 series router. So that, you know, and a 3900 series router is just an x86 box these days. It's exactly the same as any other SD-WAN appliance from any other vendor. It, you know, there's, we can argue over some finesse points about the fact that they're better. But, you know, that's the sort of approach that some companies, it's going to be modular. But the problem with modular is that you have to pay for it, for those modular interfaces or for the extra thing that goes in. I think these SD-WAN providers are just going to say, there's a software module in my SD-WAN box. It's a firewall. And you know what? It's a legitimate firewall because there is no official definition anywhere in the world for the word firewall.
Well, it's positioned in a logical place for it. I definitely agree with that.
Mm. As long as there's a piece of software in your SD-WAN box that's stateful inspection, it meets the category of firewall. Now, everything else is orchestration, is, you know, operations and management, security of the rule base, integrity of the configuration, physical security, blah, 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 right? And you know what? Those SD-WAN appliances have more physical integrity than just about any firewall I've seen on the market today.
More physical integrity. What the heck do you mean by that?
Well, a lot of them have FIPS chips, like most of the VIP Telecom has a FIPS chip inside, right? Or it has a secure crypto store. Most of the firewalls, like, for example, the Cisco ASA, doesn't store the crypto key in a secure enclave. It's just stored in flash.
Yep, I'm with you. I understand.
Right? So it's not like some of these SD-WAN products, not all of them, you do have to be careful if that's important to you. You know, some of them are actually far better in terms of the hardware integrity and where they store the crypto than you might know. And if that's important to you, go and evaluate the vendors that have that type of capability. That's sort of what I mean.
Understood. Yeah, I'm with you. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this develops.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're waving our hands and we're flappy and saying this is where we think, you know. So let's not overdo the prognostication, you know. There's frog entrails all over my desk and it's kind of bloody, and there's, you know, tea leaves and coffee grinds and, you know, whatever. But I just saw, and I'm sure there are other analysts out there who do, you know, this much deeper and much more capably than we do, but this is what I'm seeing is this. Now that we've got an x86 box running general purpose software and we've got the software-defined WAN and the use case for deploying it, what do you do with your product to keep moving that product along? Well, you put a firewall in it. You put some load balance. You know, we've already got the WAN load balancing. Can I do some WAN? I could do some simple WAN optimization. I can get an open source project that does WAN optimization.
And I actually agree with that. I just think they're going to sell it to the other end of the link. They're not going to sell it to the MSPs and the general service providers. The SD-WAN people are going to sell that to the enterprises. That's where I think the play is.
I think you're going to sell it to both. But managed service providers are here today. They're going to deploy it now. And what the big carriers do, you know, BT, Verizon, Telstra, you know, China Telecom, they're much further away. And because those businesses operate at such a vast scale, it's going to take a lot longer for them to solve that problem.
Well, have we done it to death?
I think so. One more thing I want to talk about that hardware integrity is there was an article this week saying in Bloomberg where Ingram Micro is being acquired by Tianjin Tianhai, which is a Chinese company, for $6 billion. Do you remember a while back the NSA was intercepting Cisco routers and loading on some BIOS? Some bad BIOS so that they could intercept traffic coming through those routers. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. And case in point, doesn't thrill me that a occasionally somewhat hostile government or a government that's interested in a lot of things that perhaps it has no business knowing is now in the supply chain, Ingram Micro being one of the major suppliers to the U.S. market, certainly. I don't know where all they distribute globally, but...
Very global.
Is this a potential risk that now this company that owns them somehow the supply chain could be disrupted? I mean, and you could argue, well, a lot of this hardware is coming from China anyway, so you know, why are we getting excited here? I don't know.
Well, because what you want is targeted compromise. You don't want to put it in the factory because that could be much more easily detected. So if you make it into every single chip, then theoretically, a foreign government could spend time investigating a backdoor in a chip, and because it's in every device, it's easy to detect. And once it's detected, then it's very easy to fix. Okay, you could make a press release and say these chips have been fiddled with, and then it's damaging to the business of China. Economic damage is bad. What you really want is just to be able to pick up the box just before it ships to your final destination. So you're saying I want to compromise this company, so you want to own the supply chain. right? You want to be able to intercept the box that's going to company X because you want to inject some malware into that particular piece of hardware. That's why I'm concerned about it. Now, not to say that Ingram Micro or Tianjin Tinhai is in any way planning to do this. I'm just highlighting the fact that what we need to be seeing from our IT vendors is ways, design features inside of the hardware, like my Apple iPhone has, where a crypto key that's unique to every single iPhone is installed directly from Apple, you know, master crypto server, needs to be in the equipment that they're going to ship. We need to know that there's a hardware integrity from manufacture to delivery isn't being compromised.
I agree with the concern. I don't know that the concern is any more or less of a concern now that this acquisition has happened, or it's going to be. It's just announced. You know, it's going to be happening.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not drawing. I'm just drawing the highlighting the fact that the hardware supply chain is a point of compromise.
Exactly. Yep.
And you know, calculating an MD5 hash over your iOS image, you know, your software image, isn't enough anymore.
Well, now I think we've done it to death.
Did we prognosticate hard?
We did. We prognosticated very hard. And just for those people who have no idea who we were, since I don't think we introduced ourselves in the beginning, you are who and how can they follow you?
I'm Greg Farrow, and you can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitter as at etherealmind. Also on the Facebooks, the LinkedIns, et cetera, et cetera.
And I'm Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. You can find me on my blog, ethancbanks.com, and also sign up for my newsletter, The Hot Aisle. Packet Pushers in general has a newsletter called The Human Infrastructure Magazine. Greg writes there, I write there, and we have a lot of folks in the community that contribute there as well. Go on over to packetpushers.net and sign up. And hey, Greg, last but not least, too much networking
would never be enough.